northern tribes, as at the same time Isaiah was a prophet. And let's see, Isaiah and Micah, both those two, they were prophets to the southern tribes, and Hosea was a prophet to the northern tribes. But even at that, both of them would kind of take not pot shots, but they would kind of focus their prophetic guns, you know, the other direction too. They didn't limit themselves. It's like the Lord's ministry. His primary ministry with the Jews, but every once in a while he'll cross the Gentiles, and the Paul same way. Okay, we're in Hosea 12. I went on verse 10 and didn't give it enough credence, I guess you could say, enough. We can get more out of it. Hosea 12, verse 10. Okay, we'll look at it doctrinally first, but then we can look at it as far as instruction goes also. It is one of the greatest techniques of teaching. Okay, when you and I look at it instructionally, it will be the fastest way that you could grasp information, and it will be the fastest and most efficient way to teach somebody. Okay, and what the word is similitudes. Okay, something is similar to something. Okay, Hosea 12:10. I have also, I, God, Old Testament, Jehovah, you know, I have also spoken by the prophets. And I have multiplied visions and used similitudes by the ministry of the prophets. Okay, doctrine for the Old Testament. The way God would make his words known to people before there was written revelation about an issue, he would do it through dreams and visions. Okay, at the word visions, the letter U takes you back to Numbers 12:6. And Numbers 12:6 is one of those verses you just want to get that in your noggin. Okay, just cement those, that reference, that address, Numbers 12, verse 6. And that shows that before God had written revelation about an issue, then he gave somebody a dream or vision. Historically, through the Bible, if you run chronologically, Abraham was one of the first ones to get one of these. Abraham in Genesis 15, that black guy in Genesis 20, Abimelech, he got one of these visions or dreams. Okay, now, does that mean our dreams have meaning? Maybe not, maybe so. It doesn't matter. God can use them, but the devil can use them. Okay, so you can run both ways on that. The devil can give those dreams, or God can give those dreams. Or you and I can just, depending on what we watch late at night. You know, when I was a kid, you know, if I watched a scary show at night before I went to bed, you know, I would pray about those things. And I said, Lord, please don't let me have a bad dream. And, of course, it never dawned on me that, why watch the dumb show, you ding-a-ling? As a kid, it didn't dawn on me. You'll probably be surprised at this, but one of the first answers of prayer that I received was I prayed and asked God to help me stop sucking my thumb. That was one of the first ones I remember. I was old enough to pray about that. I won't tell you. It was after I got my driver's license. No, around 7 years old. Not my left one, but my right one. You know, I didn't like the left one. Okay, and so I actually prayed about that, and the Lord took it away. So that was one of the first things I remember asking the Lord. I remember in sixth grade in basketball, we were down by 1 point, and we had 2 seconds left, and I was in the free throw line. And I remember praying, God, please help me to make these things. And I think it was the first time I ever made 2 free throws in a row. And we won the game, and our team ended up undefeated all year, so 10-0 that year. And so, you know, you pray about those things, okay? But a vision, a dream or a vision. Now, the thought will may come up, well, does God still use those today? I think he does. In a culture where they don't have a Bible, I think he would do that. But if we have a written copy of a Bible, like we do, I would not rely much on dreams and visions. Now, if a dream or vision would conflict with what the Bible says, then we obviously just throw it out the window and take what the book says. Peter gave that example. When the Apostle Peter has the most authentic odd experience, miraculous experience that anybody will ever have. It beats anything about these Fatima, it beats Guadalupe, it beats anything Benny Hinn has seen or Oral Roberts. Okay, Peter's is the most authentic vision that anybody would ever have in the New Testament, and that's when he was in Matthew 17 on the Mount of Transfiguration. Why is it the most authentic? Well, first, it's with Jesus Christ. He has two witnesses, James and John. Moses, Elijah shows up, and he heard a voice from heaven. How is the devil going to counterfeit all that when Jesus Christ is right there? Okay, and then he turns around and writes about that authentic vision, 2 Peter 1, verse 15 to 21, and he says, I got something better than that, and he's pointing to the Scriptures. So that's our standard. Okay, so dreams and visions. Okay, and so this is how the Lord would make his truths known. Now, a prophet is somebody who could prophesy or predict the future. A seer is somebody who would see the future. And then they would write what they've seen, obviously with the terminology that they understood. Okay, in the New Testament, the book that is written like that is Revelation. Okay, John, I don't know of anywhere in the Bible where it has a time machine where you go backwards in time. But in the Bible, it has people that are in a time machine that go forward in time. And John was transported, about 1900 or 2000 years in the future instead of back to the future. these movies come right from this Bible. But he was put 2000 years into the future, and then he wrote the book of Revelation. Okay, now Habakkuk was like that also. I think Habakkuk 1 verse 2, I think he says that. Okay, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk. Yeah, Habakkuk 1 verse 1. The burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. He saw these things. And then at Habakkuk, at the word see, it's got cross-reference over to Revelation 1 and 1 verse 2, showing similar what John saw. So a lot of these prophets saw these things. Zechariah saw some of those things. Wouldn't it be interesting to see the UFO that Zechariah wrote about in Zechariah 5? Weird stuff. Can you imagine these guys trying to write about this stuff? Okay, so in the Old Testament, the prophets, this is how they would make their truth known to them. And the reason why I would say if we have a perfect copy of the Bible, don't rely too much on them. I just started reading a book about a Chinese man who got saved, quite a testimony. And he writes about him personally having dreams or visions, and these things came right true, right to the head. Now, can God do that? Well, the guy didn't have a Bible, and he was crying out to God. And so if they don't have a written copy of the Bible, I would dare say the Lord would do things like this. Remember when Joseph was informed that his soon-to-be wife was pregnant with child, and he was considering that thing right before he went to sleep and went to bed. And here Joseph's attitude was, okay, what am I going to do here? If I love God, I'm supposed to make her a public example. But I love her. I don't want to do that. But I love God more than I love her. And so I can't marry her. But I really don't want to make her a public example. So I'll make her a private example. So that way I'm still fulfilling Old Testament scripture so I can keep my love for my God intact. And so he was weighing that options before he went to bed that night. And during the night, an angel gave him a dream and vision, and he told him what to do. The idea is that when a man desires the truth, God gets it to him. Whether it's through an individual, through a letter, whether it's through, maybe there's times angels came down and actually gave people messages. Has God ceased those things? I don't know for sure. But again, if we have a perfect Bible, I would say those things definitely are really put back on the shelf because we are to live by faith. Okay, now angels and devils will have a very prominent appearances all throughout the tribulation. That will be very prominent. Okay, and that's quite obvious. Hebrews 13, verse 2 talks about entertaining angels unawares. Okay, so that's a little bit of the doctrine. And the prophets, of course, we know the major prophets. The only reason they're referred to as major prophets because their book was bigger. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. And then Jeremiah wrote Lamentations. Then you got Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, and so forth, so on. Daniel is still kind of considered a major prophet, but Hosea, all to the end, usually referred to as minor, just because their books were shorter. Now, Haggai is kind of one of my favorite little books, Haggai. And if you look at Haggai's ministry, you talk about a short-lived ministry. And if you run Haggai's five sermons or messages that he gave, and look at the years, his ministry of these five messages entailed about 6 months. But yet, little as much when God is in it. And if God gives a man 6 months to fulfill his work, that's what he's recorded, then little as much when God's in it. Okay, Hosea 12, verse 10. Now, spiritually speaking, okay, similitudes by the ministry of the prophets. Okay, a similitude is the word that we would probably use more than anything is an analogy. Jesus Christ used parables after the Jews, as a nation, officially rejected Jesus Christ and called him a devil in Matthew 12. Then he went to parables. And he went to parables because he was given a truth over here through the parable, through the story, and only the sincere, humble people could figure it out, and all the rest were blinded. But a parable is a parallel story. Okay, an analogy. Okay, two very important words, and you'll see these words quite regularly through the book of Revelation, are the words like and as. Like and as. And what you do is, this is the fastest way you teach somebody. This is the most sure way you can teach somebody. And we obviously realize that similitudes are not 100% foolproof, but yet they'll give something that instructs people about the truth. What the Lord often does is, if he says, do you understand this thought here? A person may say, no. Okay, do you understand this thought here? Oh, yeah, I understand that. Okay, then he says, okay, this is like that. And that's how you get it real quick. I'll give you an example. I had a lady ask me one time about the Bible issue and about her husband willing to go to a church with her that wasn't King James Bible, but yet he was willing to go to church with her there. And she thought that was a good thing, rather than maybe go to a Bible event church, and or not church at all. And so I realized that she was a seamstress, and I just said to her, I said, well, if he goes to a non-Bible event church, is that better than not going to church at all? You tell me, is it harder to take material and make a dress from scratch, or to have a dress already made, tear it up, and try to remake it? Well, the answer for her was, that was easy. I said, so it would be better if a man's not even going to church, if it's not a Bible-believing church, than for him to go to a false church. Why? It's because you got to reteach them everything. Is it easier to paint a car If it's just got bare metal and you put the primer on and then put the metal, then put the coat, the paint coat on there, or is it tougher to take a car that's rust bucket, got the paint on it, you got to take the paint out, you got to fix the rust, and then you got to put the paint back on? Well, it's obviously a no-brainer. You see, so you use those illustrations that people understand, and basically what that is you have to know the person you're talking to. You've got to develop a relationship with them somehow. Know their background, know their interests, know what they understand, and then learn to take what they understand to teach something they don't understand. This is how Jesus Christ did it. He said to Nicodemus, he said, except to be born again, you cannot see the kingdom of God. Now, okay, so you take the first time you and I were born, and it explains the second time we're born. The first time we were born, Mama went through the pain, Mama went through the jaws of death, Mama went through all the turmoil, and she, in essence, gave life to a baby. Second birth, Jesus Christ goes through the pain, Jesus Christ goes through the jaws of death, He died, was buried, and rose again, and the only difference is that He gives eternal life, Mama gives life. Now, the slight difference, also another slight variation in that, in the first time, a baby has to rely on Mama, but really the baby doesn't exercise that reliance upon Mama. It just happens. The second birth, the individual actually has to exercise their faith in Jesus Christ by receiving Him. Interesting, I've mentioned this this Supreme Court case back in 1833. I thought, I'm going to get the lawyer's edition. Okay, they have, usually what they have in these law cases, they have the regular Supreme Court case, then they have a lawyer's edition because the lawyers aren't real bright, so they have to give them a little added stuff to it. And so it's real helpful. And what happened is in 1832, in November of 1832, two fellas robbed a postal carrier, postman or whatever, and threatened Eli's life. And so both these guys were convicted on this count. They had three times they did this, so they had six counts against them. And they received the judgment of the death sentence. Okay, they committed this crime in November and December, went to court in March, was given the death penalty. One of them was executed in July, and the other one received a pardon from the president. The president was Andrew Jackson. But this guy rejected the pardon. So he rejected the pardon, and this case went clear up to the Supreme Court of the United States. So it's called U.S. versus Wilson. And in that thing, oh man, it is a fantastic illustration of salvation. In fact, I'm probably going to make a track out of this thing. The Supreme Court said a pardon is a deed. Okay, a deed is something that somebody owns. But the deed must be delivered. But the deed that is delivered is not valid until it's accepted. If it is not accepted, the court cannot recognize the pardon. The pardon declares the person innocent. But if the person does not accept the pardon, the court cannot even do anything with the pardon. I mean, the Supreme Court knew something about that Bible when they brought out this thing. Now, what's the gospel? The gospel is a deed of Christ, what He did. He is called the Savior of the world, is He not? But the vast majority of the world don't accept Him. That's a deed. That deed is delivered. Okay, so the preacher delivers it to it, or you and I give them out a gospel tract, or it's delivered to their conscience. But if they reject that pardon, the judge cannot accept the pardon until the individual accepts the pardon. Man, and basically the idea of that thing is you tell people that story and they say, that guy was an idiot to reject the pardon. Just like every lost sinner rejects the pardon of Jesus Christ. See, and that's going to be, I'm going to use that tomorrow night at them prisoners down in Illinois after I preach to them about Jesus Christ for about 45 minutes. So I pray that that will draw them to Christ and show them that they need to accept Christ. You see, they understand pardons. And they understand the desire for a pardon. And they would quickly say, what an idiot. If I got a pardon, man, I'd be out of here. Until it comes from Jesus Christ, and then you're too prideful to take the pardon. See? And so these are similitudes. These are similitudes. And this is the surest and best way to teach in the Bible. You got Paul using sports as an illustration. I use the sports banquet as an illustration for the judgment seat of Christ. It is a perfect illustration for the judgment seat of Christ. At the end of any sports season, they always have a sports banquet. What's done at the sports banquet? The coach brags about the players who've done a good job, who's has some great achievements. The bench warmers don't get bragged about. The fans don't get bragged about. Nothing about. They do not get any exaltation at all. The ones who had the accomplishments. That's what the judgment seat of Christ is all about. You see? And the judgment seat of Christ is what Arminians know nothing about. You know, we understand the Bible teaches eternal security. And so that's a very simple thing to teach. Because of the new birth, we get born again. And so just like any other child who's born of someone's parents, they're always their parents. But can that child fall out of good graces of their parents and get disinherited? Yes, they can. But they'll never lose that family trait. You see? And so those are similitudes. Okay? And that's how Jesus Christ taught. Through studies of homeschooling and things like that, people have studied different approaches to education, how people teach. And geniuses, people who have high IQs, you know, usually are taught on the analogy methods. And the reason why is you can grasp the truth much quicker that way. And so if the Lord allows you, when the Lord allows you to teach somebody, and everybody in this room will be able to teach somebody someday, use analogies. Okay, this is like that. Okay, verse 11. Is there iniquity in Gilead? Okay, Gilead is on the east side of the Jordan River. Gilead is where, if you go to Numbers 32, verse 1. Let's see, now I have letter V, Jeremiah 8, 22. Let me check that if that one's... Numbers 32:1. Shows that Gilead is the lot of Manasseh and the two and a half tribes that stayed on the east side of the Jordan River. Okay, let's see. Jeremiah 8:22. Is there any balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then is not the health of the daughter of my people recovered? Okay, Numbers 32, verse 1 gives you the definition for Gilead. Probably a better reference could be used there, or you can just write it in the margin. Is there iniquity in Gilead? Well, the answer is yes. Then he asks another question. Surely they are vanity, or makes a statement here. Surely they are vanity. They sacrifice bullocks in Gilgal. Okay, Gilgal was the location, was like the... what do you call that? The military base or the headquarters of Joshua before they marched into Canaan land, Gilgal. I don't have a cross reference for that. You find that in Joshua. Okay, it says, surely they are vanity. They sacrifice bullocks in Gilgal. Yea, their altars are as heaps in the furrows of the fields. So they've set up a false altar over there. And a lot of times when something historical took place at a certain location, like in Gilgal, people have the crazy tendency to start to worship in that place. You know, oh, so-and-so was born here, you know, all that kind of historical stuff, which is good to a point, but it doesn't make it sacred. You know, I'd read about Benjamin Franklin and his place where he lived in England someplace. And they had did some work on this house trying to you know, get it up for, I guess, some museum or whatnot. Did some excavating in a basement and found humans that were sacrificed, adults and children. Good old Ben. Now, was that Ben Franklin? I don't know. I'll probably have Bill Sneblin come sometime shortly, if I can, and get him to teach on the secret societies in the founding of America. Now, Ben Franklin was known to hear and listen to George Whitefield preach, but yet some of these guys had a dark side, and their public side was a Christian side, but like a lot of politicians I know, but yet on their dark side. And I just saw a book come out recently. It was entitled Secret Societies Killed Jesus Christ. And I wouldn't doubt that, because the Pharisees, Jesus Christ said, ye are of your father the devil. And for a long time, I thought that was a spiritual statement. I'm to the point now where I think that's a literal statement, where the Pharisees and that crowd was a cross between fallen angels and humans. And then they showed no mercy to Jesus Christ at all. You know, people in the human flesh eventually do have some sort of remorse or concern for somebody, even in torturing. I read accounts about the American Indians when they'd catch a prisoner. And the male Indians, they would torture that prisoner, you know, for a day or so. But eventually the male prisoner would at least say, okay, we need to just put this guy out of the misery. Now the women Indians, they would never put the guy out of the misery. And when he did die, they were very upset because they couldn't continue to torture this guy. Now that's demon-possessed, major. That's sadism, masochism. But when you look at these Pharisees, these guys were so arrogant, so cocky. They knew they were killing God's son. And they thought that by killing God's son, they were going to get his inheritance. Well, that's where they messed up. And if you read the account and believe what the Bible says in that, of course, Jesus Christ, you couldn't even recognize he was a human. Okay, and man, that's like a cat studying its prey, the mouse with no remorse at all. Okay, verse 11, they were sacrificing bullocks in Gilgal, probably sacrificing people also. As we continue down this chapter, we will see what they will be doing with people. No, that's at the end of 13, verse 16, how ruthless they get. Okay, verse 12, let's see. And Jacob fled into the country of Syria. Okay, that's where Laban was. Cross-reference runyon there. And Israel served for a wife, and for a wife he kept sheep. Okay, and then that's Genesis 29. There's a history for that. You can see what he's talking about, Jacob and Esau. But Jacob took off after he tricked Esau out of the blessing. Verse 13, and by a prophet, the Lord brought Israel out of Egypt, and by a prophet was he preserved. Okay, we know that prophet to be Moses. Okay, Exodus 7, verse 1, the cross references, Deuteronomy 18, 15. So Moses was a prophet, but a prophet who would prophesy to 2 to 3 million people. Okay, but if you got somebody, that was a spare. Okay, so I always thought the angels were bowling when I heard that. Okay, and a prophet in the Old Testament, if he had a church, like a church of 2 to 3 million people, if a guy has a church of 2 to 3 million people, no doubt he's going to get a big head. I mean, if you get a church of over 1,000, some of these guys think they're hot snot on a silver platter. But most of them are just cold boogers on a paper plate. Okay, and so so But Moses, one time there's a couple of guys or a few guys came to him and said, well, did you know these Eldan and Dedan, I think was their name, are prophesying in the camp, figuring that Moses would get upset. Who are these guys? I'm the top dog. And Moses just said, I wish you was all prophets. That's why Moses was called the meekest man on earth. He was not. He did not feel threatened at all about his calling of God. And in fact, I'm sure if some of those guys came to Moses at the right time, he would have said, you want this crowd? You can have them. Okay? But Moses is quite a character. Now, Deuteronomy 18, verse 15, through verse 18, that place shows that there's going to be a prophet that comes. Capital P is used there, Deuteronomy 18. There's going to be a prophet that comes like unto Moses. So there's a similitude. Like unto Moses. Okay, so the first public miracle of Moses was turning water to blood. The first public miracle of Jesus Christ was turning water to wine, the pure blood of the grape. Okay, so Moses is a portrayal of the second coming of Christ. And the parting of the Red Sea is a portrayal of the rapture. Why is that true? Okay, when they came out of Egypt, that's a picture of salvation. But when they went through the Red Sea, it's a picture of the rapture, and there was a red dragon that was coming in after him. Okay, and so Moses is a picture of the second coming of Christ. I would say that's why the rapture is very important, to know that it is by the twinkling of an eye. Because if it wasn't that fast, if any of us look back, we'd probably see a red dragon coming through those parted waters. There's water between here and heaven. And so we will part the waters when we go to heaven during the rapture. Okay, and so these similitudes. Moses is a prophet, and Jesus Christ is a prophet like unto Moses. Okay, and then it says, by a prophet was he preserved, and that would probably be Joshua, where they went into the Canaan land. But notice what one man can do for a nation. I have Proverbs 28, verse 2 as a cross-reference. And that says, for the transgression of a land, many are the princes thereof. But by a man of knowledge and understanding shall the state be prolonged. Moses' prayers, example in Exodus 32, saved an entire nation from destruction. And so we need to realize that our prayers do things, mean things. We don't a lot of times think they mean a whole lot, but our prayers mean things. And we need to keep praying for folks. And don't quit praying for them. Okay, until the Lord may say, okay, quit praying for them people because I'm going to list you anyway. Which he did say to Jeremiah, Jeremiah 7:15. Okay, and so, but that's a rare thing. Okay, so Hosea 12, verse 14. Ephraim provoked him to anger. Okay, Ephraim provoked him, God, to anger most bitterly. Therefore shall he leave his blood upon him. And his reproach shall his Lord return unto him. Okay, the idea of leaving his blood upon him, okay, because of the sacrifices and probably of killing of people, Numbers 35, verse 33 shows that the only way you take the blood off of a murderer is by shedding the murderer's blood himself. Except for when there's a pardon. Okay, and Jeremiah was praying for a pardon, Jeremiah 5, verse 1. And in Matthew 27, verse 25, the Jews said, let his blood be upon us and our children. And that has not changed. Nothing has changed that to this day. Chapter 13, 1. When Ephraim spake trembling, he exalted himself in Israel. But when he offended in Baal, he died. That's the kind of a, that first phrase is kind of a strange thing. When you look at it like that, when Ephraim spake trembling, it looks like that Ephraim is speaking and Ephraim is scared. But the second part of that phrase would not make that true. So when Ephraim spake trembling, or when the political structure speaks trembling, meaning what they say puts fear in people's hearts, he exalted himself in Israel. What does that mean? Basically, it goes like this. When the people fear the government or government officials, there is tyranny all through ages. But when the government or government officials fear the people, there is liberty. Thomas Jefferson said, he told the statesmen of his day, he said that we have a, and I'm not getting the exact quote, but the basic idea, we have a wonderful opportunity here to keep the people alert to what's going on in our country. If the people do not remain alarmed or alert to the political structures or how things are run in this country, we, he referred to himself and all the congressmen and senators of his day, we will become wolves and devour the people. Boy, is that true. Okay, so the idea is that only the Supreme Court has said in American Communications versus Dodds, they said, it is not the duty of the government to keep the people from falling into error. It is the duty of the people from keeping the government from falling into error. And so we have a tremendous responsibility. And the more you know the law, the more bureaucrats are afraid to be around you by simply asking questions, because you could, you know, we have the laws on our side. I know there are buku laws in the books. I understand all that stuff. But the law is on the citizen's side. And if you just got to figure out which one goes where and apply it how, and just to let these people know. Now, in our country, the way our country began, we distrusted any government official. And we still are that way. How do we give an example of our distrust of them? What does the Constitution say when a man takes political office? The very first thing, what is a judge supposed to do? A judge, a politician, what is the very first thing they're supposed to do when they take office? They take an oath, sign the oath that they will support, uphold the Constitution, and a bond. Where does this come from? Look in Numbers chapter 30, verse 2. The reason why that is a lawful obligation is because we do not trust them. And Brother Bill had a case in South Bend area. I'll let him know about your case. Tell me if I'm wrong on it. And he was in front of a female judge and did a little research and found out this woman had no oath or bonds. Found out 8 judges in South Bend had no oath or bonds. What does that mean? That means they are all illegal. Everything they do is illegal. It's void. It's called void. And so he brought that up in court. He was trying to be very gracious to the judge, but he brought it up, and she said, just file it. And so he did. And when she discovered that he knew that she didn't have oath and bonds, she very arrogantly said, don't matter. And within 7 days, was it 7 days or 2 weeks, all 8 filed their oath and bonds. But you see, they don't realize what they did. The first infraction or failure to do it was a civil infraction. When they went and filed it after the fact, that made them criminals impersonating officers. But what has happened since then? Absolutely nothing. You see, a lot of times criminals just keep right on going forward. And until we, the citizens, figure this out, I know of a man in Indiana that threw every public official out of office in one county by himself. But we haven't figured out how to do that yet. And so we need to study a little bit more on those things. Okay, Numbers 30, verse 2 is the Bible authority why we require oath and a bond. Numbers 30, verse 2. If a man vow a vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth. And we have a president that did that. And then I've read an account where our president was upset because people were bringing a constitution in his face. And he said, Constitution is just a GD piece of paper. This president said that. He didn't know the tape recorder was turned off, but people heard him. Now that's somebody's violating his oath and bond. And you see, and our God views that oath as an oath with him. That's how God views that. And when a man breaks his oath with God, that is serious offense. Okay, so Hosea 13, verse 2. When these people at the top produce fear, and of course that's what they do, they produce fear in people's hearts, and they control us by fear. And then he says, but he offended in Baal, he died. Okay, so they became Baal worshipers. Verse 2, and now they sin more and more, so their sin is multiplied, and have made them molten images of their silver and idols according to their own understanding, all of it the work of the craftsmen. They say of them, let the men that sacrifice kiss the calves. Now there's a popular tool called craftsmen. That's a pretty decent tool. It's a tool probably for the middle class, the snap-on for the real professional mechanics. Okay, but I often think at the top of these corporate structures, international corporate structures, I believe in my heart that they're really demonic. Like Mobile has a red O. A red O, if you look up Lucent Technologies, which is a telecommunication company, has a red O as a symbol, and that's a demonic symbol. And I don't know if Mobile is a demonic symbol, but if I got a hunch, I would say that red O is somebody giving praise to somebody else. Okay? Nike, it's a pagan god. Okay? And I'm not saying you're not supposed to wear this stuff. I've got Juno email. Juno is a mother goddess. You see, and you and I cannot get away from this stuff. It is everywhere. Peter Pan. Okay? Let's see, which is one of Peter Pan. Let's see, Pandora's Box. The god Pan. Peter Pan. The god Pan is a cross between a goat and a human. Pan pipes. You open Pandora's Box. You get Man, Myth, and Magic. There's a whole volume down at Richner Library. If you look up the word Pan for Peter Pan, you read a hymn or a song that Peter Pan has. It's about Peter Pan. And the author says it's a, how did he write? Oh, man, it's a glorious song. And just beautiful song. And if you read the words and understand the words, what it is, the words say, if you understand what they're saying, but they write it in such a flowery language. The words say Pan is going through the woods, running after screams, and he's chasing little girls through the woods and raping them. And it has a picture in here, of a round picture of Pan sitting on this thing, kind of like he's got his conquest, and a little girl in the corner crying. That's the history of Peter Pan. You see, and we don't know these things. And I realize that if you buy Peter Pan, you're not sitting there going, oy, oy, oy. I understand all that stuff. But the idea is the devil is a consummate egotist. And so he is going to do anything he possibly can to get praise. Santa Claus. It's a male-female. Santa or Santa. In Spanish, that's holy. That's feminine. Claus is masculine. So that's a unisex creature. You know, it's Michael Jackson in action. And so that's the devil's way of stealing glory from God. Santa Claus has reindeer. That's counterfeiting the second coming. He's got sleigh bells, you know, in the Budweiser Clydesdales, and that's a counterfeit of Zechariah 14, where in the millennium that has the horses with the bells, and it says holiness unto the Lord. And even in Zechariah 6, Santa Claus takes the two words there. It says ho, ho, he comes from the north.